What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We continue Palestine Post with Dina S., born and raised in the Bay Area and an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. Good morning, Dina.
Hi, Kat. How are you?
I'm hanging. How are you, comrade?
Same here.
We're going to get, of course, into arms embargo stuff. But first, Physicians for Human Rights has issued a new report called Death Sentence for Palestinians in Custody. The report is based on 94 documented cases between October 7th, 2023 and August 2025. The report reveals that over the past 2 years, at least 94 Palestinians have been murdered in Israel detention facilities. They say have died. I changed the word. Yet the report stresses that this unprecedented figure, that's debatable, likely represents only a portion of the full death toll, given the Israelis' military practice of enforced disappearances since before October 2023. I should have proofed this for actual language. The deaths may be considerably higher. No surprises there for you, I imagine, Dina?
Yeah, definitely not. You know, actually, we've seen, so Hassan Abu Sitta, who is a renowned physician out of Palestine, he actually reported on this and said something along the lines of, you know, in his experience, he's seen organ harvesting and, you know, these bodies that are coming back from Israeli custody show clear signs of organ harvesting and very intentional, too. So they're trying to hide their work that, you know, they're trying to hide evidence of their crimes. But, you know, if you are an expert and you are in the field, there are clear signals that this is what's happening and this is a systemic issue. And so, he's trying to spread the word around this. And this is not new to your point. You know, they have been withholding bodies for decades. They've been harvesting organs, even skin, for use in Israel and just as a laboratory for their own like medical practices. And so I think it's worth noting that because this is not just, you know, tit for tat. We're holding bodies. We're having, you know, hostage exchanges. This is a systemic, like much larger, like social issue of not only, you know, the humiliation, occupation, death, violence towards Palestinians, but also stealing from them in these really intimate ways, stealing body parts, skin, their own like medical system, and the West at large benefiting from this practice. And I think it's up to us to really call that out and all the ways that, you know, they're incarceration of Palestinians and how they serve to benefit from no one calling them to account. You know, there's been no international outcry about this. There's no international outcry about, you know, the first rain in Gaza this week, which is flooding tents. It's creating unbearable conditions. There's no infrastructure. So the entirety of towns and villages and tent communities are being flooded and people don't know where to go. They're afraid to go back to sleep because they don't know if they'll wake up the next day. Children are cold, hungry, tired. So we're seeing more and more just the devastation that, you know, the ripple effect of Israel's actions in Palestine and Gaza specifically and how they have repercussions for, you know, the human and community effect like in the region and how, you know, it's only going to exacerbate as winter approaches. And we're really still seeing nothing substantial come out of, you know, Western NGOs and the UN. And so, you know, I think I think we all need to sit with that and what that means and what we could be doing more to call all of this into account.
Dina, two follow-up questions based on the things you said. I want to go back to the desecration of the dead bodies. I'm not Muslim, but from my understanding, dead bodies are supposed to remain intact. Can you talk about the religious implications, therefore the emotional and psychological implications for Palestinians to receive bodies back in these states?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, there's a very specific burial process, and it's an important and sacred process in the Muslim community. But in general, you know, there are practices for mourning somebody, for, you know, holding a funeral other, you know, ceremonial aspects to what it means for someone in your family to pass away. But yeah, I mean, this is the whole thing. Again, it's this this lack of regard for Palestinian society. It is like the desecration, to use your word, the lack of dignity, that, you know, these details often get forgotten in the grand scheme of things. But yeah, it is important. And when bodies are withheld, they're both unable to have closure. They're unable to, you know, process or have a proper funeral for their loved one. And so we see this all, again, as a systemic sort of fracturing of the social fabric that Israel imposes on Palestine.
Enough of nothing. But should Hamas return the dead bodies of Israelis having their organs harvested, what say you their response would be?
I mean, I think that the way things are playing out now, you know, we're seeing coordinated efforts to return bodies to the communities they belong to. And I think that there's cooperation there. And for me, it feels like in that way, the ceasefire, the so-called fragile ceasefire, is continuing to hold. And, you know, we're seeing more chatter, more conversation on at the Knesset of Benjamin Netanyahu, not sure if he thinks the ceasefire will hold, speaking about it passively, when in reality, you know, the only person, one of the only players who can control the outcome is himself and his cabinet. And so, again, I do think that's worth noting as well, that, you know, the very delicate ceasefire really depends on, I would say, honestly, him and his cabinet. And so we don't know what it will look like. We don't know what they'll decide tomorrow. We're already seeing the conditions change. You know, there's a UN Security Council vote today, which would really influence and change what it would even mean to have a ceasefire, a so-called ceasefire in Gaza, and, you know, the return potentially of boots on the ground. And so I do think that it's important, again, for us to track these things as they're happening. And for now, we're seeing still the ceasefire and its stipulations are being upheld, although we are still seeing many ceasefire violations, which have sort of escaped the notice, you could say, of Western news. And
not of me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
266 murdered. That's the count that we have since October 10th as an undercount.
Yeah, surely. And despite that, you know, Western sources are holding out hope, they say. And so, we don't know what that will look like. Yeah. But again, some of the bigger stipulations are being followed through on.
I think my point was, and I don't want to linger here because there's more important things, that the last so-called ceasefire, right? One of the reasons that Israel gave for the escalated bombing of Gaza was the conditions that the bodies were being returned in. So the hypocrisy for me is deafening. Oakland arms embargo, because I only got 6 minutes with you left, so I want to be sure I get that in. If we've got time, I'll ask you something else. But what is the status? Are parts still being flown out of the Oakland airport to go to Israel to make weapons to bomb children in Gaza?
They absolutely are. You know, again, like we've been saying, ceasefire is not, you know, there's still violations on the daily. They're still bombing. We're seeing actually quite literally that they are still undergoing bombing campaigns. So we know that the weapons flow has not stopped. It's just changed. It's shifted form. And so we have to keep the pressure on our institutions and remind them that this isn't over. And they're still, maybe the nature of the battlefield is shifting, but the weapons are still flowing all around us. And not only that, but, you know, the Oakland public, the people of the Bay Area are, you know, growing louder in their calls to get this supply chain out of our airport. I mean, even last week, the Alameda Labor Council voted unanimously to endorse the campaign, which is significant because they're the largest labor body to support ending these shipments. And they represent about 135,000 Bay Area workers. So that's not nothing. That's a huge number of folks. They're in healthcare, transportation, education. And it's not just them. They're joining the ranks of over 150 Oakland businesses, other unions, organizations, and 10,000 people and counting have signed onto the petition. So we're trying to demonstrate to these institutions, to city council, to the mayor that, you know, the calls are only growing louder. More and more of the people who make Oakland, Oakland, who the people who've made the town what it is, are calling for the end of this because this does not represent Oakland. And so we're really hoping to build upon this win and really, again, demonstrate the might of our campaign and to push in the ways that we need to push, get the right institutions to stop, to stop these weapons and to even realize their own power in this supply chain. I think it's very easy. There's many players involved. I think it can be easy for someone to say, you know, that's not our jurisdiction. We don't have any control over that. But we've even seen the Port of Oakland take a stand, even during apartheid South Africa. You know, when they stopped shipping weapons to, or sorry, shipping goods to apartheid South Africa, we saw the city of Oakland follow suit, and then we saw the rest of the country and the world follow suit. So it's not for nothing. I think, again, like our region has immense power and people are looking to us and they follow our lead in a lot of ways, especially with respect to social justice. And I think a lot of our work here is making people like realize that we have a history of leading and doing the right thing and following our moral compass. And I think what's really beautiful is that the people in Oakland are not going to let our institutions, our elected officials forget that. And so, we continue to have the conversations we need to have. We continue to build power. We continue to appeal to bodies like the Alameda Labor Council, who have enormous sway in our region. And the calls grow louder. And that's all, you know, that's within our power. That's what we feel like we can do in this moment.
Brass tacks logistical question, Dina. I'm assuming the workers at the airport are unionized. I can't imagine that they're not.
Not all of them.
Okay. The workers that are loading the planes, do we know if they're unionized or are they just community members that have jobs at the airport?
My understanding is that FedEx is not unionized.
So who has sway over FedEx?
There's a number of players. You know, there is, again, the Port Commission, the City of Oakland. There's a number of people who have their hands in what goes on at the airport. And so I think, too, even to your point about if the workers are unionized or not, there's a lot we can do really to educate those who work at the airport. And we're even seeing those who are unionized who work at the airport. You know, they're having conversations, they're making their voice heard at the Port Commission meetings. They're saying, it actually sickens me to work, you know, a few gates away from what I know to be planes being loaded up with weapons components headed to Israel. It sickens me. I can't sleep. I'm anxious. People are sharing their own perspective and their stories as people who are also at the airport. Like, I think, you know, even if it's not FedEx, FedEx doesn't work in isolation. The airport doesn't work in isolation. It's all part of a grander sort of ecosystem that has to do with our city, our streets, our civilian infrastructure. And so there's a lot of opportunity there to pull the right strings and to have the right conversations.
There's the petition. Where can people find it and sign?
They can find it at armsembargonow.com.
Okay. Armsembargonow.com, y'all. Armsembargonow.com. And Dina, what are our marching orders in this moment? What is the call to the people to do right now?
I think we need to really stay vigilant and understand how the U.S.'s positionality in the Arab world is changing. You know, there's a UN Council, Security Council vote today. And depending on the outcome of that vote, but even whether it's yes or no, we know that the U.S. is looking to have boots on the ground in Gaza, have a U.S. occupation of the region, and we cannot allow that. Our movement is an anti-war, anti-imperialist movement. We do not want increased U.S. militarism anywhere, especially in the global south. And so we need to continue beating the drum of what it means to be in the Bay and to fight an anti-imperialist fight. And we need to really build with our brothers and sisters and other organizations who are taking up similar work, because this struggle is not, again, in isolation. It is connected to every other struggle. Every other struggle that has fought for sovereignty from the U.S., this is all our fight. And so I think we can continue to build with our partner organizations, continue to leverage our strength, because there's more of us than there are them. And I really think that we can tip the scales in our favor and make sure that our region is not participating in this warmongering, especially as the U.S. looks to intensify its influence in Gaza.
Nina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
See you later. Thank you.
We're speaking to Dina, who was born and raised in the Bay Area and is an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. Quick announcement: tomorrow, Tuesday, November 18th, at 6 o'clock p.m., the Oakland Public Safety Committee will meet again. The last meeting was canceled due to illness. We'll meet again to consider renewing and expanding the soon-to-expire Flock license plate scanner contract funded last year with a loan from the state of California, and adding additional Flock surveillance cameras. The price tag for this Flock expansion and renewal is $2.25 million from a city that is absolutely broken, a state that don't got no money. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, November 18th, 6 o'clock p.m. at the Oakland Public Safety Committee meeting. If you want to make a comment virtually, you have to sign up to do that today, no later than, I believe, 5 o'clock p.m.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.